I've been thinking a lot these days, this last period of time, about assumptions. The kinds of assumptions we make about what we're capable of and what we're not, about aloneness, about connection, assumptions about where strength is, where power is, assumptions about happiness, where that is more genuinely to be found. And I've really just become fascinated with that kind of exploration of all of the assumptions that we tend to make and the potential for mindfulness as a power of mind, as a quality of mind, to come very close to our actual experience so that we can actually see the arising of that that whole process of making an assumption. And this is very closely tied to what in the Buddhist tradition is also called papancha, which is one of those words I've always liked because it's one of those words that sounds like what it means. You know, it sounds like popcorn, right? And what it means is proliferation, papancha. As I heard one translator once describe it, he described it as the imperialistic tendency of mind, where something arises and the whole world is taken over. All that we are and all that we will ever be somehow gets interpreted as a facet of that experience, that quite transitory immediate experience. And the way I usually try to describe papancha is through the story of this time I was once teaching with one of my colleagues, my friend Joseph Goldstein, and we were just teaching somewhere, and we were sitting in the kitchen having a cup of tea when somebody came into the kitchen in a state of some distress, and he said to Joseph, "I just had this really terrible experience." So Joseph said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "I felt all of this tension in my jaw, and I saw what an incredibly uptight person I am, and I always have been, and I always will be." And Joseph said, "You mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" And he said, "Yes, and I've never been able to get close to people, and it's never going to change." And Joseph said, "You mean you felt a lot of tension in your jaw?" And then, you know, he responded with some very elaborate story of all of the, you know, infinite implications of this tension in his jaw forevermore. And it was really interesting for me kind of watching them go back and forth and back and forth. And finally Joseph said something to him like, "Why are you adding a miserable self-image to a painful experience? You know, it's painful enough to feel all of that tension in our jaw, but on top of that, we add on all of these interpretations and a future that is locked in, that's never going to get better. We add on so much to what is already a genuinely painful or difficult experience." And so something we almost say in jargon or meditation lingo is look for the add-ons. You know, what might we be adding on to what is actually our experience right now? Another way of saying this is that so often the experience that arises for us and the interpretation, the conclusion, the judgment, the assumption, the add-on, they happen so quickly that we tend to conflate them and assume they're one. You know, that there's this experience and inevitably there is this particular reaction. When they seem to merge in some way, when they come together so they seem as one, then there's a certain sense of inevitability, of permanence, of solidity, of rigidity, of universality. Everyone must react always in this precise way. I must inevitably always react in this precise way because this experience and this reaction are one thing. But actually, one of the roles of mindfulness is to be present enough with our experience so that we can see there's the arising of the experience, and then there is the reaction, mutable, changeable, contingent, born of conditions. And we see this countless times. Many years ago, when as I just gave this talk in L.A., and I said in this talk that people like Joseph and I are of a generation of meditator in this country, or you could say meditation teacher in this country, so that in the day, like when I first came back from India, which was 1974, having been there for a few years practicing meditation, the general climate in the country was such that if I was at a social situation or a party or something, and somebody would say to me, "What do you do?" And I'd say, "I teach meditation." They would kind of go, "Oh." And sidle away like it was so weird, you know, and freaky and so on. And now, the single most common response, whether I'm like coming through customs or whatever it is, when somebody says to me, "What do you do?" And I say, "I teach meditation," the most common response is, "I'm so stressed out." You know, I could really use some of that. And my favorite response is, which happens sometimes, you know, I say I teach meditation and the person will say, "My partner really needs to meet you. They should really meet you." You know, so it's like a different world in a lot of ways. But back then, we started the Insight Meditation Society in 1976, and some of our friends came to us and said, you know, our parents are extremely upset about this strange new thing we're doing, meditation, and they don't seem to understand, and it doesn't work for me to explain it, so why don't you maybe have a retreat for people's parents? And so we did. We called it the Parents Course. And we gathered all these hostile, frightened people together and offered a retreat. It was very interesting. And we knew, for example, that even though our retreats are generally held in silence, that especially silent meals were not going to fly, you know. And so we decided to eat with everybody and just have conversation. And the first morning at breakfast, somebody leaned across the table and said to Joseph, "You've kidnapped my daughter and you've brainwashed her and it's not going to happen to me." So that was like the general tone of the retreat at the beginning. But 5 days later, it was very different. It was completely different. So we decided to do it again. And one of our friends said to us, "You know, I'm thinking about inviting my mother to the parents' retreat, but I'm very reluctant at the same time because she's the kind of woman who's going to spend one night here." And, you know, the center's like way in the country. She said, "My mother's the kind of woman who's going to spend one night here, and the next morning she's going to go marching into the office and say, 'Those goddamn birds kept me up all night.'" But she did invite her mother, and what was really spooky was that she knew her mother very well because her mother did exactly that. She spent one night there, she went marching into the office, and she said, "Those goddamn birds kept me up all night." But after 4 or 5 days, she was hearing the sound of the birds very differently. There's so many ways we can hear a sound. And this implies a world of possibility, of creativity, of generativity, not being locked in, not being imprisoned by habit or the force of reaction. Not too long ago, I was in New York City, and I was sitting in a cafe waiting for a friend. She was really late. So I pulled out my cell phone, which is virtually never on, and I turned it on, left it on the table, and never rang. And something like an hour later, she showed up. And I said, "Where were you?" And she said, "I called you 4 times, but you never picked it up." And I thought, oh, my cell phone's not ringing. So I spent hours, literally, pressing things, trying to get it to ring. I never got it to ring. And that night I was teaching with a colleague. And as he was speaking, someone's cell phone went off. So then when it was my turn to speak, I used that as an example of just this. Very possibly the person whose phone it was felt some humiliation. Other people might have felt some irritation. I felt a tremendous amount of envy. I was sitting there thinking, I spent hours trying to get my phone to ring. I can't get my phone to ring. That person's phone rings. And not only that, they have a really good ringtone. They have a better ringtone than I had when I had a ringtone. They don't even have a ringtone. That is actually the truth of experience. One sound, many reactions. And we ourselves might have many different reactions depending on conditions. It's a very contingent universe. With all this, like a confluence of conditions coming together to make up this moment in time. This is freedom. Doesn't mean that we never react. It doesn't mean that we just sort of become apathetic or uncaring or distanced or flat. But there is some space so that we can understand we have options. And within those options, we can be creative. We can remember what we really care about. We can let go of that which we know deep down causes us suffering and causes suffering for others. And we can do this almost in a playful way. It's not like trying to improve ourselves in some sort of driven, nasty way, like, oh no, I had another horrible thought, I'm the worst person in the world, I better squash it. It's not like that, but it's really understanding this huge sense of possibility, that there's openness, there's movement, there's flow. And we can turn our attention in ways we can incline our minds, is the classical Buddhist phrase, we can incline our minds toward that which is genuinely about connection and about understanding. So as one example, we can see that when we make an assumption and we don't step back to notice we've made an assumption, we then start creating a story. That's when we build a mythology, a narrative. And we tend not to step out of it once it has been created. I was also just recently talking about, those of you who've been to the Insight Meditation Society, let me start here. When we first went to look at the building in Barry, it was December of 1975, and we were thinking about buying it so that we could open the retreat center, and we started out with a tour, of course, and we got to this one particular wing of, it's got all these different wings, we got to this one particular wing, and Joseph, who grew up in the Catskill Mountains of New York in a resort that his family owned, he looked at that wallpaper and he looked at just sort of the design and he said, "This looks just like a hotel in the Catskills." So it was like a joke, right? And then time went by. We decided to buy it. We moved in February. We moved in on Valentine's Day, actually. And the place was so sprawling, we had someone go around and make a map. We had like a resident cartographer, as we said, you know. And they just made a map so we could find all the bathrooms and things like that. And they put the map on the bulletin board in the entryway. And there underneath that particular wing, it said Catskills. And I thought, that is so funny. You know, Joseph made a joke. Haha. And, you know, well, this will never stick, right? So that was 1976. Guess what we call it today? The Catskills. So a few years ago, one of my friends, when you come there to do a retreat for the first time, one of the staff members will guide a tour so you can find your way around. So one of my friends was on this tour one day, and they were in that wing, and the tour guide, the staff person, said, well, this is the wing known as the Catskills. So my friend said, why? Why is it known as the Catskills? And he said, this is the wing that lies closest to the Catskill Mountains. So, which actually is not true. It turns out it lies furthest from the Catskill Mountains. But at any rate, this is what he said. He said, this is the wing that lies closest to the Catskill Mountains, so we decided to call it the Catskills. So my friend finished his tour, and at some point he recounted this remark to me, and I just looked at him and I said, why in the world would we name a wing because of its proximity to the Catskill Mountains? It was a joke. It doesn't mean anything. But I thought, what an interesting illustration. You know, something happens, it's never questioned, becomes an assumption, legend grows around it, becomes collective. Nobody wants to say, how stupid am I? I don't think that's true, you know. And it just kind of grows and grows and grows and seems to be the way things are. It takes a certain adventuresome spirit. It takes a certain amount of courage to step back and to question. Again, it's not critical in the sense of criticizing. You know, it's very playful. It's very interesting to notice all of those assumptions. I can't do this. This will never work. All of those add-ons that we can be so accustomed to. This is all my fault. I should have been able to stop this. Why wasn't I in control the way I should be? It's quite interesting. One of the arenas I think about this in terms of is what in the Buddhist teaching is sometimes called sympathetic joy, which is the ability to be happy, to rejoice in the happiness of others, rather than falling into great envy or jealousy, as though to fall sway to that very common voice which does arise within us when we witness someone else's success or good fortune, that voice that says, ew, you know, I would be happier if you had just a little bit less going for you right now. You know, you don't have to lose everything, but if the light could just dim a bit, I'd feel better. Which is a very common thing, and clearly it causes so much suffering for us. You know, as we're constantly feeling embattled and nervous about what someone else is getting, or having, or succeeding in. So what are the assumptions? It's quite fascinating to look at just the perception, the distortions of perception, the assumptions that underlie the generation of so much envy or jealousy. Things like, happiness is a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for me. Or, you have everything and you will forever. And I have nothing and I will forever. That assumption of permanence, right? Or there's a very odd one, which is quite hard to describe, but it's some kind of sense, almost like the success or the good fortune or the accolade was floating around in the air, and it was heading right toward me. But somehow it landed on you. And if it hadn't landed on you, it definitely would have landed on me. So you are the obstacle to my perfect happiness. Whereas, you know, sometimes, of course, we are in direct competition with somebody. We've both applied for the same job or the same grant. But a lot of times, it's not like that. But we live as though it was like that. So it's quite powerful, and clearly it's very liberating to just examine, to investigate the kinds of assumptions that are layered within our very great unhappiness at times. You know, to constantly feel so cut off and jealous and disliking someone else's happiness and all of that is a very painful state. And it's actually painful for the other person, in a way. I know we have probably all experienced something really good happening for us. And some people are so happy for us, and it feels so beautiful. Whereas other people, it's like they may smile, but you really get the feeling they would be just fine if everything fell apart for us. And it's very painful at the same time. So we look at the nature of our perception. We step back. We need to be both very present and very spacious to be able to pay attention in that way, to see this is the experience, this is the story I'm telling about the experience, or this is the experience, this is the sound, this is the feeling, this is the thought, this is the external experience, and this is how I'm projecting it into a seemingly unchanging future. Where this is what's happening right now, and these are all the layers and layers of blame of myself I'm putting on top of it, and trying to bear that all at once. Where this is the experience, and this is my assumption about control. All of that is quite fascinating. And this is part of the power of the state of mindfulness. It's not that we're trying to make believe we're not feeling what we're feeling, but we can be with the feeling so deeply that we can see almost through to the heart of it, and the kinds of assumptions and thoughts and perceptions that are generating that. And then we have a choice. Do I want to act from this? Do I want to let this go? The first crucial, critical step is to know what we're feeling as we're feeling it. Not to be so busy, so distracted, so disconnected that we just go on into action without experiencing that quality of space. And the example I've been using for years, which is still my very favorite example, is, you know, getting quite irritated or angry and not even realizing that you're angry, and then going off to the computer, typing out the email, and pressing send. You know, and then maybe like 2 hours later, you go, whoops, I guess I was really angry. And I said that in a way that is unlikely to actually get me what I want, because it was so full of hostility. And then, as I'm sure you know, certain email programs where if the recipient of your nasty email is using the same program. Program's probably not the right word, but you know what I mean. Domain. Then, like on AOL, for example, if the recipient of your nasty email is also on AOL, there's a magic button you can press called unsend. And it's like something in your computer reaches out into theirs and it just pulls it back like it never was. So you go rushing off to your computer, and of course, always, 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 they've already read it, you know, and it's way too late. It's not a small thing to know what we're feeling as we're feeling it. To be in touch, to be aware, to be connected to the whole range of our experience. And also to have a certain relationship to the range of our experience. So we're discerning. We have clarity. We can see the distinction between what's happening and all of the interpretation and judgment and future projection and all the many things we may be layering on, to let go a little bit. Maybe this pain is not going to last forever. And in any case, we can't experience a forever pain right now anyway. Maybe things will work out in some way. I have a mantra I've devised for myself in periods. I've noticed in my own mind, in periods of a lot of travel, where something's always going wrong, you know, if I find a sort of anxiety jag coming up in my mind, like, oh no, I missed the flight, then I'm going to miss the connecting flight, and that means I'm going to land in that little town, it's going to be really late, probably they don't have any cabs, what am I going to do? It's going to be like 2 in the morning probably, and they're not going to have any cabs. I have a new mantra, which is, something will happen. Like, something will happen, right? I can't work it out right now. Something will happen. So it's some process like that, you know, which has a little bit of amusement at oneself, and certainly recognition of what's going on, and an ability to make a choice. Make a choice for happiness or make a choice for freedom. Like, I've been down that road before. I've spent 6 hours on an airplane trying to figure out what I'm going to do when I land. Doesn't make any difference. Might as well enjoy the plane ride. Something will happen. I like to think of our entire lives as an artistic medium. You know, how we relate to ourselves, how we relate to one another, the choices that we make, the efforts that we put forth, the relationships that we have, that it's all our own work of art. And so we practice. Very much with that flavor, to cultivate mindfulness, to cultivate compassion, to cultivate qualities like sympathetic joy, to cultivate the sense of balance or spaciousness that allows us to make choices, to see the ways we are contouring reality, to realize we can let go, is a very beautiful thing, actually. In India, you know, there's a very famous saying, which is something like, when a pickpocket sees a saint, they see only the saint's pockets. And that's what I mean by assumption. It's that kind of tunnel vision. Who do we see? Who do we not see? Who do we discount? Who do we ignore? Who do we look right through? Who forms the other? It's all part of that same process. Which parts of ourselves can we integrate and accept? Which parts of ourselves do we reject or refuse to even allow to come into our consciousness? It's all part of the same process. So the key to our freedom and our cultivation of all of these very beautiful qualities is mindfulness. It's knowing what our experience is and having a certain balanced relationship to it. And that is really the essence of our work, of our practice. So do you have any questions or comments, anything you'd like to talk about, anything that I said, anything you experienced in the sitting, or anything at all? Yeah?
Something you said about that, though, is the word that is
a propancha.
Propancha? I think it's something I recently read that was just phrased in a certain way, but what it was that when you found it, what it was to notice our misery, and that the source of our misery is always the ego. And that if we can get to a point where we really notice that and take it in, then that's where the dropping of the ego comes up, so it's trying to fall.
Instead of trying to what?
Instead of trying to drop the ego, oh my God, I'm humble again.
So the question was about a quotation. You might have to help me again. About if we're feeling miserable, then the root of that is our ego, and that the source of our freedom is not trying to drop the ego, but seeing. Is that right? Seeing the complete nature of that misery or that relationship.
That's where our mystery comes from, the ego, then gradually the ego will follow
us. Okay, so if we realize, I like that, grok. that's the source of our misery, then gradually, as we see that, our ego will fall away. Right? Okay. The way I have thought of that in terms of the Buddhist teaching has to do with this sense of it's not so much a question of the ego, but it's a question of the ego as we make it out to be, which is alone, separate, bounded, in control, impervious. That we tend, this is in terms of the teachings, we tend to have a pretty distorted perception of the nature of things, and that includes that. And so the more clearly, and that certainly is a source of great unhappiness and misery, because we are defending that which really can't be defended. We are trying to control that which can't be controlled. We feel incredibly cut off and alone, whereas the truth is we are part of an interconnected web of life, and we're not alone, in fact. So the more we see things in a mistaken fashion, the unhappier we are, and the more we cause suffering for others. And so I, like many people in the beginning of my meditation practice, was made quite uneasy by this thought of selflessness or egolessness. It really seemed like death to me. You know, like there was this little being inside that had been accompanying me everywhere and showing me, you know, what to do, and that was going to kill it. And I was quite frightened, actually, by it. By that notion. And it was only when I sort of got a better understanding of the nature of the Buddhist teaching, in which he was saying it's not a question of killing the ego or destroying the ego or annihilating anything. It's a question of trying to see things as they actually are and not having ignorance and habit contour our day and guide our lives, you know, which is just really making for unhappiness. And so I think the more truth we see about our experience, even if it's painful, it's important. And the more clearly we can see things without distortion, you know, without assumption, the happier we'll be. So it's kind of like in that light, you know, that I see that point. Yeah?
In certain quest for that. We're sort of surrounded in a culture that's based on fear and hope. You know, we've had 8 years of fear, you know, red alerts, green alerts, yellow alerts. Now we have hope. Mark's getting better, the sky's over, the war's ending, whatever. How do you walk a middle path between those two created fantasies?
Okay, so the question or the comment was, we live in a culture which tends to go between fear and hope on maybe every level, you know, including kind of a social political construct as well as personally. And again, you know, from within the Buddhist tradition, words tend to be used very precisely. So the word hope tends to be used as attachment, you know, and I don't think it's either the sort of common, you know, political understanding of hope right now. But, you know, so the opposite of hope is in hopelessness within the Buddhist tradition, which is no fun either. But the word hope, hope and fear, hope and fear, hope and fear, hope would tend to be really like attachment. You know, it's a very particular definition of where happiness is to be found. It's a rejection of other possibilities. It's a wish to be in control, to have everything work out on our timetable, according to our precise definition of how it must work out. And it's considered to be inextricably tied to fear, that we just go from hope to fear, hope to fear, hope to fear, and in that particular sense of the word hope. But the word faith, for example, would be considered somewhat different than that. So, although it's not a popular word necessarily, because it's laden with all of those other meanings of dogma and belief and such, it doesn't really imply that in the Buddhist tradition. It's more a sense of having a sense of possibilities. You know, so that we don't feel completely locked into circumstance. Either we can see a bigger picture of life or we sense a bigger picture of life. We don't feel defined by our circumstance, or we sense the possibility of inner strength, of some resilience. We have a sense of connection to others. You know, one of the things that I find an extraordinarily strong cultural conditioning in this society is the isolation that comes with suffering. You know, if you're not feeling really good, it's your fault somehow. You know, if it's our own unhappiness or suffering, there's often such a sense of needing to hide it, feeling ashamed of it, we should have been able to stop it, we should have been able to control it. If it's someone else's suffering, there's such a strong sense of, well, let's just tuck them away somewhere, you know, so that we don't have that unsightly view. You know, and it's such a desperation not to accept that that's a part of life. And one of the consequences of that, of course, is tremendous isolation. You know, so faith in that particular sense would be understanding that we're not alone in joy or in sorrow, that we are connected to one another in a much bigger picture of life. And so that, I think, is really something very different than that dance of hope and fear and hope and fear and hope and fear. Also takes a lot of investigation and I think personal exploration to come to, because it is out of that common dynamic.
Last year I was here and I asked a question about this concept of no self, and then like I said something to the effect, well, who's the person that's driving down the road? Yeah, is that, you know, would you have to be conscious of yourself when you're driving the avenue? I think he said something to the effect that, well, on a relative basis, there's the relative self, and at the same time, maybe on an absolute basis, there's no self. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, I mean, I was just curious, is there more?
Is
there more? Yeah. Can I recommend a good writer that has elaborated on it? Or
mm-hmm. So the question was about this concept of no self, and the sort of question, like, if you're driving down the road, who is that? You know, and certainly seems like me. And I had said in the past, in response to that question, something about relative self and absolute self. And so could I elaborate on that and also recommend somebody's writing? So before I forget that second part, I would say, you know, one interesting person to look at is Bob Thurman. In a lot of his writings, he'll go into this. And you can just check out different books and just see what's there. And it's very much this sense. It's not, you know, sometimes we hear a teaching like no self and it seems like in that moment of annihilation everything will dissolve and, you know, there's not going to be any distinction. It's just like a soup. And or, you know, one of my favorite ways someone once asked it was they just randomly pointed to someone else in the room and they said, if there's no self, how come she's not paying my taxes? You know, and so it's just, there's a certain assumption there too that in that realization of no self, everything is just going to break down in terms of distinction. So that's where the idea of relative and absolute self comes in. Of course it's you driving down the road. You know, of course it's you paying those taxes and no one else's taxes. But what is the you? You know, it from the Buddhist point of view, that sense of self, that ego, that is me or you, is fluid. It's connected and interconnected with all of these influences and so on. It's not in control. It doesn't mean it's inert or has no effect on anything, but this idea that we should be in control is very strong in us, actually. And if it were really ourself, it should dominate. You know, we should be able to say, I'm not going to die. We should be able to say, I'm never going to be afraid again, or I've grieved enough. You know, I'm done now. But instead, the reality of life is one where everything is contingent. It's interconnected. Everything's born out of conditions. Every moment of our experiences, all these conditions coming together and coming apart. It's a very different sense of this self. So it's not that it disappears or is erased, but it's seen to be very different than what we might commonly assume. And that's why they say there is a relative self, but it's not absolute in the way we normally hold it to be. In Tibetan tradition, they say, sometimes they say, it's like nothing exists from its own side. Nothing exists independent of causes and conditions, including our deepest sense of who we are. And so it's all moving, it's all flowing. Or just one way, I normally probably did this last year too, talk about it, both this and loving kindness, is if we all just now for a few minutes reflected on the different people that are involved somehow in our sitting in this room together right now. Because none of us was just like walking down the street and thought, poof, let me go there. Right? We're all here as a confluence of connections and relationships and influences and encounters. So let's spend a few moments just reflecting on that. How many people gave you a book or told you about their meditation practice or read you a poem or played you a piece of music? As I, you know, often in talking about myself, I say that I went to India that first time as part of an independent study program at State University of New York at Buffalo. You know, so I went to study Buddhist meditation with their blessing and their money, you know. So sometimes when I'm doing this reflection, I think about the Board of Regents. You know, gave me a Regents scholarship, or the chancellors of the university, or the head of the American Studies Department who approved my project. Every one of us, it's layers and layers and layers of connections. That's this moment in time. And sometimes when I'm doing this exercise, I think about some people whose actions have really hurt me. Not just the ones I find kind of annoying, you know, or irritating, but the ones with whom I really felt like I was going to an edge, where I said to myself, I've got to be free of this. This is haunting me. I've got to get through this. Or I've got to see another source for happiness, very different than what I have been counting on up till now. Because in a funny way, those people are part of why I'm sitting here now too. So many beings for each one of us. And how many beings have been involved in the food that we've eaten today, even if it was not like distinctly an animal product. You know, creatures who live in the soil. And who planted that seed? Who harvested the crop and transported it and prepared it or sold it to us? Many lives come together in that bite of food. So that's a certain perspective on life that is true. It's not like fanciful or sentimental or woo-woo or weird. It's actually quite true that all of life is interconnected. That every moment in time is a product of all of these conditions coming together, coming apart. That we're not so alone. That our sense of who we are doesn't need to be so cut off, and so on. So that's the process of really exploring the relativity of our sense of self. Yes. I think you're going to really have to shout, or else come forward. Okay. Oh, you can. Wow.
A good boundary or acting out of fear? What are some tools or
tools? Okay, so how do you know when you're just setting a good boundary or acting out of fear? I'm sure this has actually come up a lot over the weekend, actually, because I think it's very connected to that topic of fierce compassion. I think that is a whole process of paying attention. And we can know, absolutely. We may not know perfectly and we may not know immediately, but the more we actually practice something like mindfulness, the more we cultivate it in a formal way, in a dedicated way, the more we know. You know, the more we can just tune in. We tune in through our bodies. We feel it. We see what's motivating us. which is really the key component in your question. We see what our intention is, because as you're implying in the question, the intention or the motive behind an action isn't necessarily evident through the action. You know, we can do the same exact thing coming from a lot of different places, and on the surface it looks exactly the same, but actually it's very, very different because the motivation is really different. You know, so we could give somebody something, it could be an act of generosity, or it could be an act of martyrdom, like I don't deserve anything, so I'll give it all away. Or it could be an act of manipulation. You know, I'll give you this because I see you have that. And I think, well, hey, you know, I'll give you this and you'll give me that maybe. Or, you know, a thousand other possibilities. And so we look toward a certain sensitivity of what's motivating us, to be able to discern really the nature of the action, not just the act of giving or the act of saying yes or the act of saying no, but really trying to pay attention. And our body is really one of the best ways of just having a clue what we're feeling and what's guiding us. And that becomes a principal part of the practice over time is really tuning into what's motivating us. And here too, there's the possibility of making choice in a way that's very gentle and very kind toward ourselves, and just honoring what we actually care about. You know, it's not necessarily punitive and it's not judgmental, but it's really, it's kind of exciting, you know, to think, well, I've done that, you know, so many times. I'm gonna try coming from this place, this motivation, you know, this intention, or I'm gonna try this other way and see what happens. Okay, so the question was, could I give some examples from my own life of just what I was saying, you know, feeling my body, the sensations of a certain emotion or certain intention, and then going in one direction or another. I don't know if I have an example that is coming to mind that is especially stressing the sensations, you know, but that is maybe the most common way in which I or others can pick up that sort of emotional reactivity. And so I'll tell you a story. It's just the first one that comes to my mind. Ooh, fizzy water. I didn't even know. I'm lucky it didn't spill all over
with the video.
A couple of years ago now, I was traveling from the East Coast to Maui because Ram Dass, who's an old friend of mine from my time in India, has been living there, you know, as you know, probably, you know, he had a stroke some years ago and made an amazing, miraculous recovery in so many ways. And after a period of traveling a lot and teaching, he decided just to stay in Hawaii. Not a bad choice. And I was going to lead a retreat with him and with another old friend, Krishna Das, whom some of you may know through his music. He was just here, I think, actually. doing Hindu devotional chanting. So Krishnadas told me back on the East Coast, he said, listen, this is what you have to do in terms of traveling. He said, get off the plane in San Francisco, spend the night in an airport hotel, get on another plane the next day and go to Maui, otherwise you'll be completely exhausted. And, you know, you'll be a wreck and you'll get sick. So when I called my travel agent, I said, oh, you know, I think I should get off the plane in San Francisco and spend the night. And he said, no, don't do that. He said, I have a great flight for you. You know, it's like 2-hour layover in San Francisco. You'll get to Maui, you'll really be rested, it'll be fine. So I said, okay. So then I got on the plane, you know, time went by, I got on the plane, landed in San Francisco. Of course, it wasn't a 2-hour layover, it was like a 6.5-hour layover. And I started thinking, I am so stupid. You know, I'm so stupid. Why did I do this? I'm going to be really exhausted, I'm going to get really sick. This is so stupid. You know, why did I do this? And I could just start to see the cascade of self-judgment beginning to build. And there was a moment. So there are different components of that moment. It's recognizing what we're feeling and then having a certain relationship to that so one neither dives into it nor spends 6.5 hours hating oneself for it. I can't believe I'm judging myself. Why am I judging myself? I'm always judging myself. I shouldn't be judging myself. I've been practicing meditation for 70,000 years. Why am I doing it? How many hours I've done? I'm still judging myself. You know, so that's another possibility that's not that useful. So somewhere in there, we recognize what we're feeling. We have a kind of balanced relationship to it, neither getting overcome by it nor hating it and hating ourselves for it. So that's mindfulness. So that's what I got to. You know, I saw what was starting to happen and I basically let go of it. I thought, I don't want to go there. I don't want to spend 6.5 hours miserable in the airport. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to have a good time. And that was it. You know, and I did. I had a fine time in the San Francisco airport. I got to Maui like a gazillion hours later. And like the next day or something, I saw Krishnadas. And I said, oh, KD, I really should have listened to you. I was like so stupid, you know, to get off the plane. And he said, no. He said, I had the worst experience. He said, I got off the plane and I went into the airport hotel. I couldn't fall asleep, and I finally fell asleep, but I had to get up in an hour in order to, you know, get on the plane and go to Maui, and he said, I'm so tired, you know, and I said, I'm so tired too, from which I took a few lessons. One was, it's actually kind of hard to get to Maui from the East Coast, and the other is, we can always blame ourselves, you know, that litany of self-blame, where it's really not rooted in anything. And we made a choice. I mean, who knows, right? So it's all those components. And especially, you know, since you asked about sensation in the body, it's really to recognize what we're feeling is aided quite a bit if we can have that sort of sensitivity. It just reveals often, you know, the nature of what we're actually feeling. So, someone else there had a hand up? Yeah?
I was wondering if you could reflect on just kind of from your own life or just from your perspective as a teacher over the years, of what are the belief systems or assumptions that trip people up on this path? Are there any kind of standouts to watch out for?
The question was, in terms of my experience as a teacher, what are the kind of, or are there some very common patterns that seem to come up that tend to trip people up on this path? So the first thing that came to my mind was, I can't do this. And I find that in the West, in contrast to, you know, places where I've studied, like India or Burma, the common cultural norm can be one of feeling incapable somehow of actualizing a truth. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But even if it's not cultural, even if it's more universal, I've seen, for example, within Buddhist teaching, there's a tremendous emphasis on effort. In fact, maybe I should even go back further and say, you know, one of the most important things, there were two, it was twofold. Some of the most important things ever said to me were from my two earliest teachers. The first of whom said, the Buddha did not teach Buddhism, the Buddha taught a way of life. You know, so our work is not in any way about trying to be a Buddhist or rejecting anything else, but to really examine that way of life and to see what's appropriate for us. And then the second was another one of my early teachers who said to me one day, the Buddha's enlightenment solved the Buddha's problem, now you solve yours. And it was actually a great moment for me. I know often in telling that story, I feel like I'm not quite conveying the incredible kindness in him in saying that, but it felt almost like it was the first time in my life someone looked at me as though to say, you can do this. You can solve the problem of the confusion and the unhappiness that has brought you here to India to begin with. You can do this. So within the Buddhist teaching, there's tremendous emphasis on effort. No one is going to give you the truth, but no one can take it away from you. The Buddha only points the way. It's your own effort that will make it real or not. You have to practice. This is not a question of just believing what someone else says. Put it into practice. See for yourself what's true. It's kind of a breathtaking view of human capacity, actually. It's not like the Buddha said, follow me, you know, and everything will be fine. He said, put it into practice. He said, don't believe anything I say. You know, don't believe anything anybody says, a great elder or anything you've read in a sacred text. He said, put it into practice. You know, so there's a lot of emphasis on one's own effort, which I find very often in the West that's construed as sort of terrible, you know, because it meets a very strong conviction often of, I can't do this. So effort gets retranslated as strain, struggle, trying to be someone we're not, trying to feel what we're not, trying to deny what we're actually feeling. You know, there's so many things that get mixed up, whereas actually that teaching about effort, I think, was in a way the Buddha's single most liberating offering. It's an invitation. It's like, wow, you know, you can do this. You can do this. And there are tools. They're very realistic, practical, pragmatic, immediate tools you can put into play that will help you. But you have to do it. It's not just a question of, it's too bad, really, because it's easier just to think about it, you know, but it's not going to work. You know, so I think there's some core feeling of almost like prior defeat or something that, or being incapable, or having, another way of saying it is having a very small sense of aspiration. You know, not to really think it's possible for us. I had a Tibetan teacher once who used to say to us, this is a paraphrase, but kind of like saying, why is your sense of aspiration, like your sense of possibility, so meager? You know, why is it so small? Why not aspire to be a completely liberated being for the sake of all beings? Like, why not? You know, and so some of what we encounter for sure in our practice is that why not? You know, and so we work with that. Yes.
Why do you think the math is hard?
Why do I think the path is hard? I think a few things about that. I think the path tends to be intermittently hard, but we remember the hard parts. Really. And I think some of that is orientation or habit. You know, I've had teachers say to me, and this is not my personal inclination, it's not, I'm a New Yorker, you know, but I've had teachers say to me things like, you know, you're sitting and you're with the breath and your mind goes a gazillion miles away, and then you realize it, you should be so grateful that you can begin again, that you discovered your attention was wandering, that you kind of came back into consciousness, that you can let go, that you can begin again. You can be filled with gratitude right in that moment. Like I said, it's a stretch for me. You know, it's not really the way I tend, you know, to see things. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it? That we may not appreciate all the moments we're present nearly as much as we despair because of all the moments that were absent. And so another way of saying it is my experience in teaching very much has been the case that people often make progress that they discount. And so, for example, I find that as one is practicing, you might still get caught with the same kind of, let's say, minor provocation. And it might still be a really big reaction, like anger, to that minor provocation, but it won't last as long. And if it used to last all day, it's going to start eroding. So you're still caught and you're still really angry, but finally it's going to be half a day and then less than that and less than that and less than that and less than that. But when it's half a day, it's a really painful half day. Very few people jump up and down and say, wow, this used to be twice as long. You know, it really hurts. And so it kind of takes a stepping back in some perspective. And actually, very often people say, and I've seen this too, that it's their friends or family that notice the changes first more than they do. Because we're all caught up in our own minds, whereas somebody says, wow, you're different. You know, maybe even before we can see that. But anyway, so that's part of it. And part of it, I think, is because it's also hard for us in this society because the dominant message is very different. And we have to rely on both a great inner strength and a sense of community often to really have a sense of these kinds of values. You know, so that's part of it. And part of it is that it's very different than our own personal conditioning. We have to question a lot, really, really a lot. And then maybe the last thing I'll say is that we're just trained differently. You know, we're trained to be distracted. We're trained for our attention to jump all over the place, to have the patience to just start again and start again and start again. It's very difficult. But it's also obviously very rewarding, you know. And so if we can make that leap, which is actually probably the hardest thing of all, to not just theoretically appreciate a path, but actually breathe life into it. If we can do that every day, you know, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is, but make it real, then it will be transformative. But that's the hardest part, actually. It's much easier to talk about this stuff, or even frankly to write books about this stuff, than it is to sit down and do it. And so for all of us, that's the magic. That's the magic moment, is to not just think, oh, fine for the Buddha. You know, so many people say this to me because I spend so much time these days in New York. You know, people say to me all the time, well, it's fine for the Buddha sitting under a tree, you know. Too bad I live in Manhattan. You know, or I will practice when it's not so noisy. I will practice when I'm not so busy. I will practice when I don't have so much going on, when things aren't so tough. Well, it's like, good luck, you know. We have to practice now. And so to appreciate that, and it's not like a chore, but it's this amazing realization, like, wow, I can make this real. In my circumstance, the way it looks right now in my life, you know, that's the most important thing we can do. Okay, thank you. May you be happy and peaceful and well and all good things. And I'll see, I'm sure, at least some of you tomorrow and the next day. I don't know if you have any further announcements. If there's anything. Okay. You're free.